Blog Talk Radio.
Educating Black women about her story from all schools of thought. Radio, dedicated to Black women and the study of who and what we are.
Black Womaniverse, her story moment. Drusilla Dungy Houston, teacher and historian, 1876 through 1941. Out of anthropology, ethnology, geology, paleontology, archaeology, as well as history, I have dug up an irrefutable arsenal of facts that Harvard and Yale, or cowardly scholarship in our race, dare not refute. How can a leadership point the forward way that is utterly ignorant of the past? This is an excerpt from Louisiana Weekly, September 13th of 1938. Were it not for Black Classic Press, 1985 reprint of the book Drusilla Dungy Houston, self-published in 1926, few would know to praise this wide-seeing mind of the Midwest. The book was The Wonderful Ethiopians of the Ancient Kushite Empire. It was the first in a planned three-tome survey of ancient Black African history and its gift to Western civilization. Of the volume that did get published, bibliophile author A. Schomburg had this to say, quote, "I can assure everyone that the author must have used considerable oil in her lamp, represented by her extensive research and the indefatigable labor that resulted in the astonishing compilation before me." Unquote. Houston's scholarship came before the trailblazing work of Dr. Yosef Benyakinen, Chancellor Williams, John Henry Clark, Malefi Asante, and others we rightly esteemed as pioneers in African-centered scholarship. She, like George Wells Parker and J.A. Rogers, was working to disprove a negative that African Americans came from an inconsequential people and had no past worthy of excavation. Keep in mind, this was long before the modern Black studies movement that has made present-day scholarship far easier. Speaking of research, there's plenty to be done on the life of Drusilla Dungy Houston. What we know is that she was born in Winchester, Virginia, and lived for a time in Minneapolis before settling in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. There she worked with her brother, Roscoe Dungy, editor of Black Dispatch. We also know that her father, an educator and fundraiser from the American Baptist Home Mission Society, filled her with a tremendous sense of race pride, as Houston put it. Another formidable influence was W.E.B. Du Bois. It was after reading his groundbreaking The Negro in 1915 that Drusilla Dungy Houston was fully prompted to dig up her past. I just want to say Ashe and thank you to our teacher and historian, Drusilla Dungy Houston. Ashe.
Peace and blessings, everyone. This is your host, Seek Wisdom, and you are listening live to the Black Womaniverse Radio. I am so excited about our broadcast today. We are going to be speaking with none other than Nubia Warfa Polk. She has just come back from a dig in ancient Nubia in Meroway. So shortly, she will be joining us on the line. And if you are not familiar with her, you can go to her website, which is ancientnubiandigs.com. And we need to support this sister in everything that she is doing. She, like I said, just came back from a dig in ancient Nubia, and she will be going back later this year. And she's definitely looking for Black women who are interested in supporting her and going over there to participate in the digs. So we will get into some information about what she discovered while she was there. If you have not already done this, go onto Facebook and find her. You can find her by typing in Nubia Vicky Wardford-Polk, and friend her. Send her a friend request, and you'll be able to look at the pictures as we go through today's broadcast, where she will be speaking about everything that she discovered while she's on the line. Now, I'm getting ready to pull up her line, but I know there's a favorite of hers that I want to play, you know, just as a thank you, one of our thank yous. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and play one of her favorite songs, and then we'll go ahead and get her on the line. Radio, so you can tell us all about what you found, and we can look at some pictures. I'm just excited.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here. Excited to be on the show. You were the first person, actually, that had me on the show talking about the project and, well, on the internet, you know, talking about the project and what it was, what I was going to do, and the support that our community has given us nationwide, internationally, everything. So, you know, it's all coming together, and I have you to thank for it, partly.
Well, I am just helping to share this information because we need to support you in what you're doing, and we also want to say thank you for everything that you're doing because it is not necessarily easy all the time to do some of the things that you are doing. So we just want to send that love and that healing and show that in support of you. Could you let us know about your website and how we can donate to you? I put your email address in the chat room, but if you want to go ahead and share that information with us before we, get into some of the pictures and everything.
Okay. Well, my husband is working on getting my little computer in operational order, but my website is ancientnubiancities.com. That is ancientnubiancities.com. As of today, I have a blog, and people can ask questions. I'll open up discussions on different aspects of my research, one being the African origins of religion, or just the origins of religion, which is African. You know, it really is redundant to say the African origins of religion, because religion is an African invention. To praise the Creator, to praise those the spiritual world.
Your phone is breaking up just a little bit.
Just a little bit. You know, my phone just my phone breaks up a little bit. We can't really remedy that. We've been trying to over the last couple of weeks. So
we'll work around it.
Okay, thank you, and. Again, my website is ancientnubiancities.com. It's just been updated, so we can definitely keep in contact there, and I can keep you abreast of what's going on. My email is nubiandigs with a Z at yahoo.com, and you can also call me at 313-864-0708. That's 313-864-0708 to ask further questions or email me, or you know, some people don't feel comfortable with the internet, and I'm really kind of I'm okay with that. You know, people just calling me because this is our business number anyway. Okay, Sister Tara, did that cover it?
Oh, that covered it. I'll make sure we get to that again toward the end of today's broadcast, because we definitely, again, we want to support Sister Nubia and everything that she does. You know, we're feeding off of this knowledge and this information and the pictures and everything that she has brought back to share with us, firsthand primary research. So we need to show that by supporting her. Again, we can go to her website, which is ancientnubiandigs.com, and there is a donate button on her website, so we need to show that support.
My website is ancientnubiancities.
I'm sorry, I just messed up. But I have it correct in the chat room. But again, ancientnubiancities.com. So, all right, well, let's go ahead and get into a little bit of information of reference to your dig. Let me see if I can get to the link so that we can share the pictures. Now, I don't know if they will be able to view the pictures if they're not one of your friends on Facebook.
I think they can. I don't have it closed like that, I don't think.
Okay. Well,
but if they are just on Facebook,
put the link in here so they can get to that.
Okay.
All right. Now, could you go ahead and just start us off and tell us about, when you first arrived there on your dig, and just give us some brief information while everyone gets a chance to get to the link that I've posted.
Okay. Well, I can go in for you. I left in January 2010, trying to get everything together as far as my entrance into the university. That's been a long meandering journey, to say the least, to get into the university, to get settled. Had to come back in the summer and get my credentials verified by the State Department in Washington, D.C., to go through those channels, many channels, through the city, through the state, and then finally to the State Department, federal government, And then took the papers back, presented my papers to the University of Khartoum to Professor Ali Usman, who is my supervisor. Many people may know Ali Usman and don't know it. In the Africa series presented by Skip Gates, the first person he talked to was Professor Ali Usman, dressed in a white robe and in a jalabiya and a head wrap, and that is my professor. And he was standing there, and he was talking about the University of Maryland that was predominantly run by women professors, women scholars, 6,000 years ago. So that's part of, you know, that's part of my studies as well, to find out the foundations of that. I also in my meeting people at the Nubian Studies conferences and the Meroitic conferences that I've gone to in different parts in the world, Paris and Vienna, have friended anthropologist Dr. Richard Loban, who is a professor at Rhode Island College, a professor emeritus now because he's retired, but he still has links to the college. And he is doing excavation at Abu Aratella, that is about two and a half, three hours northwest of Khartoum, that in Sudan. Khartoum is the capital of Sudan. And the Abu Aratella site is in a village near Kabashia. And this was their third season. I was invited to participate in the dig for this season, and to supervise it when people are not going to be at the site, you know, make sure the rest of the digs are going smoothly, as well as it's supervised always. Every site is supervised by the National Museum in Sudan. And we got there on our spot, which is on the I think it's on the northeast corner of the excavation site. And about 6 inches under the dirt, we found a burial, which was a surprise because the ground penetrating isn't sensitive enough to pick up skeletons and things like that. They really just do give you the architectural parameters of the site. They don't, you know, you can't see the pot sherds and you know, and anything else in the site, but you can see the parameter of the site. So the first 6 inches, which means that the burial is probably fairly recent, we found the burial, a human burial. The one I found was a man, we think between 500 and 1500 years old. It's quite old. There weren't any remains left of his clothes, so it's quite old. And the second human remains were found by the Italian team. There was an Italian team. I was the African and American team. And then there was a Russian team. And the Italian team ran into, actually, it wasn't, it was the supervisor in camp, a Sudanese supervisor, Umaima, who actually first found the bones of a human burial. And so that's the first layer of occupation. Then we found pots and pot sherds with charcoal inside of them, probably maybe about a foot deeper into the ground. And we found several of those. There was a line of pots, which indicates some kind of consistency. It could have been a kitchen, could have been a manufacturing place or something, but there was charcoal in the pots. So we're not sure if it was on top of the temple somebody was living for a while, or we're really not sure what was going on with the site. And since the burials are on top, and at a point in history, people were in that area, people were having burials in their home. People were buried inside of their home because they liked the person to be close to them so that they could perform the rituals, that is, giving the people food and drink and that kind of thing. So, and we also found the perimeters and outskirts of a temple wall, of what we think is a temple wall. We're not exactly sure if it's a temple wall, but we know it is a wall. And we also found the top of a of a column that we're not sure what's going on with the top of the column, because there's writing on it, and we're not sure if it's a temple. You know, we suspect it is, I'm not sure. And the top of it is in the Meta Netcher hieroglyphics, and it reads, "The Lord is the truth." So that's pretty much in a nutshell. I was there for 10 days, and that's pretty much what we dug up. We also, the interesting thing there, Tara and listeners, is that there's always a suspicion, I don't know why, with the archaeologists and anthropologists in the historical world, that there was not occupation in that part of the world, that is, people living in that part of the world. Are you still there, Tara?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello? And and just checking on my phone, that people were not living in that part of the world. You know, as the Egyptians said, that their origins were from the south. Well, we found some Neolithic pottery, which would suggest that people were living in that area more than 60,000 years ago.
Okay, which area are you speaking about right now?
I'm talking about at the archaeological site in Qabashiya,
okay,
which is in
okay,
northern Sudan. People are thought to have lived in that area, you know, just pretty much moved there pretty much in modern times, not to have been occupied in those areas for times before 6,000 years ago. You know, they say that there wasn't evidence, whereas, you know, it's Qabashiya Meroe. That area is, which is the civilization of ancient Meroe, if I didn't mention that before. And the civilization is at between the Atbara, where the Atbara River comes off the Nile River. And people just lived along river basins, especially in that part of the world. It does not rain. It rains maybe two or three times a year. And so, you know, for historians to just assume a lot of these things, to me, it doesn't make sense. But since as they say, science hasn't proven, which means it hasn't been found, it's unknown. But oral history in that region says that the people have been there ever since the creation of Earth. So I know that the myths and creation stories, so-called myths, because we're finding out a lot of these myths are not myths at all. They're stories that have been changed a little bit by time, but they have a very truthful base. So, you know, I'm there to check it out and see what's going on.
Okay, now I noticed, I'm looking at some of the pictures now. Let's see, it's one picture you have of the royal bathhouse. And
Yes,
you mentioned that the original paint was on it. And the painting that's on it, you can still see the colors and everything. Could you talk about that picture and that find there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the painting, this bathhouse is actually a sacred bathhouse. It is let me get you the proper name for it. It is dealing with a so-called water cult. It's called the Royal Water Sanctuary at Meroe, and you can see the three seats where the people that were the head of the so-called cult or so-called religion, because it really isn't a cult. It's a cult in these times, but in their thinking, it's their religion. So if there's three seats where the queen and other people of the religion would sit, and it has symbols in it that we discussed briefly in our conversation, the iconography suggests a lot of ancient beliefs. The mouths of the lion where the water pours out of in that temple suggest the lioness and the feline belief, a pedemic, And that's really, really, really important, because a pedimec and the felines and the cats and the jaguars and all of those are feminine symbols, usually sometimes even with peats. And it could be a male or a female, but it signifies, it goes back to an ancient past, which we believe has to do with the women ruling the world, women being likened to cats, to the wisdoms of a cat. The leonine representations are such as Bastet, a pedimec, and these pass all over the world with the jaguars of the Mayan beliefs, as well as we know that there was some contact with the Africans of this period with the people in Southern America. So this bathhouse is really, 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 really an important part of the religion, because the bathhouse is very important because it is a divine beginning, because it has to do with water, okay? It has to do with water. So it's very, 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 very important. You see the steps leading down to the royal bathhouse there? In the royal bathhouse?
Yes, that's what I was just about to see, to say.
Okay.
So I'm looking at the picture of the royal sauna in Norway.
Yeah.
And
right.
Amazing pictures. Some people can't get to them because they're not, I'm looking at some of the comments.
Facebook.
It looks like they have to be your friend in order to see these particular photos.
Oh,
so,
okay. I'm sorry, but there's a mouths of lions lined up around, which suggests this the feline, which they would call cult, and you know, so this royal this cult, we don't know if it's only royal, or if other people are invited, or, you know, we just can't tell, you know. So you have marvelous down here with this picture with the column, with the cap of the column, but it's not the full column. And and you know, it would have been the full column. And the bathhouse looks, they built a roof on top of it. The bathhouse would have been outside, pretty much, with probably a more temporary roof, maybe a wood and thatch roof, kind of thing for the bathhouse. Just kind of shielded against the weather and the elements, pretty much, it looks like.
Okay, and I'm looking at the picture of some of the bricks now, because you talked to us about the about what you found with some of the bricks on some of the buildings.
The bricks, as far as on that picture?
On that particular picture? Oh, no, I was looking at, I was going forward to another picture.
Okay, which one are you looking at? It's the bricks with the column?
Hold on, let me go back to it so I can see what...
Okay.
The one in particular... there was one, like the one here says Remains of Royal Palace. That was one picture. But then another one, when we were speaking yesterday, you mentioned how they, you know, rubbed their thumb across the bricks and made
indentations
on the bricks, if you could speak on that.
Well, we know that the indentation on the brick, where you see that there's a, anyone who's looking on Facebook can see it, that there's a brick that is actually coming out of the, that is coming out of the wall. And if you can see those three lines, all we know is that those bricks seem to show up at temple sites. Temple sites are built of stone, more permanent type of building than mud brick. The mud brick houses that their dwellings that they lived in these times, they don't stand the test of time, but they build the temples out of stone, and they have a stone foundation. And that's why they're around for so very long, because their religious buildings were built out of stone. That's all we know about it. Meroe is very mysterious because people don't know very much about Meroe, and people don't know very much about this civilization.
All right. Now, I know during our talk yesterday, we mentioned, I want to touch on this briefly. A lot of people would, some people would listen to the conversation that we're having about history and archaeology and anthropology and just come away with, you know, why is this important to me? And specifically, since this show is geared toward women, why is this information in terms of history and the depictions of women, why is this important to us? Why does it matter?
It's first of all, it's a very strong place in history for African women. Very strong place in history in African women. African women ran this total region of Punt, Kush, Nubia, Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia. They were pretty much ran by women. Remember, in this area is where Queen Makeda came from. The Queen of Sheba, and she was the one that kind of put people in check as far as telling Solomon, you know, who was the richest man in the world, you know, you're messing up the economy. You're rich. Yeah, you're a great guy, and you're the richest man in the world, but you're messing up the economy by doing certain things. Well, for her to come and talk to him in this way kind of tells us that she had an authority because she was speaking with the king. So this part of the world is very, very important for us, and these are lost pages in history. The Nubians are in Kushites, which are synonymous, are pretty much written out of history because it is thought that their contributions to the world are not very important. But we know that in Khartoum, particularly, they call the people the Khartoumian people. That is the place in the world where there is longest evidence of civilization, longest evidence. There are rocks. There's pottery with design. When you have design and artwork on pottery, then you can, in tool making, you can decipher that from, because the apes are doing certain things with tools and things like that, and you can decipher that they're not ape-like, that they're intelligent men, and that these pages need to be replaced back into the world history book because they have been systematically deleted from the contributions of the world, and that's why it's very important. Not only for just myself and all the people that are interested in Black history, it's world history that these contributions should be admitted to.
Okay, and psychologically, what type of impact will this type of information do for a lot of Black women who, you know, have not heard of some of the information that we're talking about right now, because that has a big impact. Can you touch on that briefly for a moment?
Sure. Psychologically, you know, we're worked on from our, the most spiritual part of us, which our worship in God. And some of these finds are telling us that, you know, God was worshipped as a woman in physical form at one point, as well as the psychological impact of knowing that women were involved in contributions to the world political history. They were contributing to the world in the scientific realm. They were contributing to the world in so many different ways. And whereas, you know, we've been obliterated from the pages of history as women, as people who have taken out our contributions and, you know, the wise oracles and the sibyls and all those Africans that were actually the counselors to heads of state in ancient times, you know, their names have been deleted from history. We talked briefly about Hypatia, who was taken from her classroom, dismembered, and the skin torn off of her bones, because she was teaching these things that she was taught to most likely from Black women from Africa. That's how she knew it. And they said she was a practicing witch. So, you know, at this, and we're talking 4,000 years ago in Greece, in attitude in Greece and Rome, when they were trying to get rid of the black leadership. Because the people that were at the top, they knew better. But, of course, they say these things to the masses so that to rile them up. And of course, it's to dumb down the masses. She was teaching to anyone that would come to her classroom. And, history, the psychological, think of what that did to women in that society psychologically. She was one of the few women teaching, and then she was killed and dismembered. Do you think many of them stepped up to teach a class after that?
Of course not.
Do you think that? Yeah. Do you think many of them? I mean, so if you obliterate it and you lead a terror campaign, which is pretty much what has been happened to us, you know, the terror campaign of removing ISIS, offset from the pages of history. Her contributions, the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, and where she was, you know, where Osiris was becomes the Holy Ghost, you know. There, you know, it becomes just the her and the Son, you know, this immaculate conception to make us think that there is no divine feminine, no divine masculine, there's no balance, there's no, it just has been turned around. And as we said before about the Damiana, Sit Damiana, which we means lady, our great lady, who is the oldest known drawing of a Virgin Mary with thorns around her head, with a
Whoa.
Crown of thorns, coming from ancient Nubia.
Yeah, we did touch on that, Sit Damiana. Mm-hmm. And can you spell that for the listeners in case they want to try to find some information on it?
Did you go and look? Where you found very little, I'm sure. It's not very much information out there on Sit Damiana. SITTDAMIANA, but it's pronounced Sit Damiano. That's how the people of Nubia pronounce Sit Damiano. And actually, it was translated for me by a Nubian sister who's one of my best friends in Sudan, and I was trying to say, I'm trying to find information on Sit Damiana. She said, you mean Sit Damiano? And, you know, because I was pronouncing it wrong, she didn't know what I was saying for weeks, and finally she figured it out, and I said, Sit means lady, right? And she said, yes, that means lady of our great lady. So she knows of stuff like that, and many people, but they call it pagan because many of the people in Sudan are pure Muslim now. Islam has made an effort to wipe the practice, the religious practices up off of them that they used to practice, but it's been incorporated inside of Islam to the chagrin of many religious leaders.
Okay, I need to go back to, we were talking about the burials and how they were, in most cases, in the homes and how they did the burial rituals. Can we go back to that a moment? Can you talk about the importance of those burials being at a location and why, what was different about the Nubian burial ritual in addition to how the women were found versus how the men were found? Can we touch on that for a moment?
Well, the Nubian burial ritual, which is still practiced today, you know, just to let you know, is the people are buried within the homes, many times with fiance necklaces, blue stone necklaces around the women's feet and their neck. Sometimes flowers are put in the grave, excuse me, as well as grave goods are put in, those things that they will need in the afterlife. They're usually buried in a burial sheath where, if you can see these pictures online, you can see that that they have no clothes on, and that gives us an indication they're very, very old. Then the people will come in to build the burial place in the house, and they will do rituals that involve honey, water, and give food to them. So it's just, you know, it's just very, very, very traditional for people to do that. Even still today, in certain holidays in northern Sudan, people go to the graveyard, and they give they put palm leaves on the grave and they, as well as they, which actually has, is Christian, some remnants of Christianity, and they add they pour libations of water and give the body honey and bread and bring flowers, which is, that's not an Islamic practice at all.
All right. Now, I'm trying to look through my notes from when we spoke. I have a lot of things written down. Did you want to talk about the Anglosari or the Dogri, or did you want to go to something else?
Oh, no. You asked the question.
Okay.
So we'll answer them. The Anglosari we were talking about, I mean, it really fits in. It really fits in because the Anglosari are remnants of the old religion. You know, like I put up sometimes every periodically on my Facebook status, give me that old religion because it's good enough for me. I think when our ancestors and our elders said that, I don't think they were talking about Christianity at all. You know, but this old religion is where they recognized the Anglosari on the top of their body. They are looking like an ancient Nubian woman, the hair parted in the middle, going straight down, and the top of the body being a woman, a human woman, into the waist, and then the bottom is a fish. The Anglosari are supposed to be what people call the angels of the Nile. And the Anglosari will give you wishes, will grant wishes, heal people, tell you wise things. So, you know, the Anglosari are those beings that people say still are at the Nile River, and that many people are going back to this old religion as well, as far as going back to the religion and practicing seeing the Anglosari. And the Dogri. The Dogri are the D-O-G-R-I, D-O-G-R-I. They are they're the physical living beast, and they're evil. They're supposed to eat human beings. Will physically beat you up, drown you if you go in the water. So those are the evil side, and they say that they can tell the way a Dogri looks when they're in their human form by the shape of the eyes, and then their eyes glow at night.
Yes, and the thing that one of the sisters just put this in the chat room, but I was about to say the same thing as well. The description of the Anglosari reminds you of the Starbucks logo.
Uh-huh. The Starbucks logo?
Uh-huh. The Starbucks logo is of a woman with a part in the middle of her hair. She has, like, wavy hair, and she's got, like, stars around the top of her head, like a crown. And then the bottom half of her body is a mermaid, a fish.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
exactly what the Starbucks logo is.
That's I've never really noticed it. I don't drink coffee, and I don't pay Starbucks any attention. But again, like we were talking about, this iconography is very important, you know. And these are the things that they tell us not to believe, that they believe in their self, you know, that they believe in their self. So it's very, very, you know, it's very, very important for people to look at all the iconography and buildings. You know, me and my husband were just talking about yesterday, and, you know, a lot of the iconography and building is not only Masonic, it's satanic. And it also, you know, it's deals with geometry, mathematics, people's pagan religion, all kinds of things. So, you know, iconography is important. And, of course, Starbucks, you know, their main component in everything is what? Water. So
yeah.
it would make a lot of sense. They couldn't do anything. Water is divine, and it's a divine symbol. Even when people go to the I interviewed a Ugandan girl. She's 19 years old. What a brainiac. I wish she could come to the United States, and, you know, I'm going to do my best to get her here to go to school. But she, you know, she's blessed with she being able to speak 15 languages, English, Ugandan, a couple of Ugandan languages. She speaks Amhara. She speaks Kikuyu and a couple of other Kenyan languages. But she told me that her grandmother told her point blank. She said when we go to the river, the bottom of our bodies turns into a fish, just the women. And when they pray, their prayers are granted. They said when people start turning over to the Christian religion, that their prayers were not granted any longer. So many people are going back. There's a phenomenon in Sudan, especially southern Sudan, where people are laying down Christianity as well as Islam, and they're going back to their ancient religion as well.
All right, let me see. There was a question in the chat room.
Mm-hmm.
I think someone wanted you to clarify what you meant by satanic when you were talking about a lot of the symbols on a lot of the buildings and things.
Well, some of them are going back to, you know, really just it's not you know, like some people say that the ancient worship, you know, that attributing to much of the women is called satanic. Some of it is pure worship of dark forces to bring about whatever it is they want. Some of the Masonic symbols are not the positive symbols, because of course we know that comes from the mystery system, coming from ancient Nubia and coming from ancient Egypt. Well, they had a balance to control it. If you only display symbols from one side, from the negative side, from the dark side, then those are the satanic symbols. You have to do rituals, which I have no idea what they are. Don't want to know what they are at this point. At this point in time, I'm studying something different. You know, that they're not balanced. Specifically, there are symbols on top of their pentagons. There are places in certain buildings that people go and do certain things, all kinds of things. I'm not being very clear on it because that's not my area of research. But I do know that they exist, and if somebody did a tour with me in my hometown of Detroit, I could show you some symbols that I'm talking about in some of these buildings that exist here. Excuse me.
All right. Okay. Now, let's see. Let's get into a little bit of the information in reference to what's going on social and politically in Sudan. Can we get a little bit into that and what's going on in Darfur? Talk about that.
Well, you know, I can give you a very brief overview because, again, that's not my area of expertise.
Oh, wait.
But I can tell you. Yes?
Before we get there, I forgot to mention one other thing. Can you touch on how you were received by the community and the people there in Sudan when you got there? How they treated you, being an African American woman, and what they thought about you, et cetera. Can we touch on that?
Yeah, we can, because it's good for people to know. You know, it's good for people to know. You know, in general, I got the pre-state. Sudanese people are very, 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 very nice. Very, very. Probably the most hospitable people I've ever met in the world, because the behind that is they don't want you to have a bad impression of Sudan. they don't want you, you know, because people, you know, sometimes you come from someplace else, they're wondering, why are you here? You know, what are you doing? You know, why are you, you know, they pretty much will ask you those kind of questions, and you just kind of have to explain them away. But, you know, a Sudanese household, a Sudanese family won't ask you to do anything for them. They won't ask you to pick up anything. You can't. You are served hand and foot food. Sheets changed every day. You know, just given tea and snacks all day. And, you know, you just come out of there probably a couple of pounds fatter after a couple hours visit. And that's what I want to you know, stay preempt is the following statement is: the Sudanese men. They are influenced by the Western media. They think that any woman from the West is up for grabs, that she is willing to do immoral things without much social contact. All right? Do you know what I mean? So in the first couple of hours you meet somebody, so the first couple of hours you meet somebody, and then they say, well, you know, maybe soon I can come over your house and we can have tea. In the United States, you'd say, oh, well, yeah, maybe sometime in the future come have tea. We can look at television or something or look at a movie or something like that. In the United States, of course, you had to be careful here too, but that wouldn't be considered just a totally, totally foreign thing where it wouldn't be accepted. Well, in their culture, they don't do that, those kind of things. So just that statement is totally rude and it's totally unacceptable. In their culture, in Sudanese culture, women are always in twos when in the company of a man. If you ask a woman out to coffee or something and she's most likely not by herself, unless it is your wife, it is a relative, or it is a sister. And they do marry their first cousins. So if they're trying to begin courtship, they don't approach the girl themselves in the first place. They approach their family. So just a direct contact and asking to have coffee in a private location. If they ask you to have coffee in a coffee shop or something like that, it's not as bad, but usually a woman is not on any in any doesn't go on dates unaccompanied by a friend. Now there are a few instances that I've seen that is changing, but it's not widespread at all.
Now I have to back up a minute because you just said something that we didn't even touch on yesterday: marriage to first cousins. Did I hear you correctly?
Yes. Yes, they marry their first cousin, so they keep it all in the family. And in ancient times, that was done to keep wealth in the family.
Definitely.
So they still have that practice. Most people in that part of the world still do that. So it's not this practice predates Islam, as you've probably seen in some of the Metternetra texts. It talks about marrying my sister. Well, sometimes you don't really know whether it's a sister or a cousin because they use those terms, they interchange those terms. So you're not sure whether they're talking about physically their sister or their cousin. But your first cousin, actually, you're closer related than your sister because you have more relatives on both sides, you know, more relatives than a sister. So, you know, there are birth defects in this part of the country. There's also a lot of dwarfs, probably due to this same practice. There are a lot of dwarfs because if you get that gene on one side and then you marry your first cousin and then they have it on their side and those genes meet, you get a dwarf. There was a family I lived with in their apartment building. They had two dwarf children. That's very unusual. They had a son, their firstborn, and their youngest daughter. Very smart children, but just, you know, he even been to college in Malaysia, and Sanaa, she was, you know, she was very smart girl too, but you know, he in the face, he looked just like the demigod Bes. You know what I mean? It's prevalent in a culture. That's why Bes was most likely, they said Beth was a twat, but most likely he was a dwarf.
Yeah, when I'm hearing you say dwarf, every time I hear you say that, I'm thinking twat, because, a lot in that region. Now, the other thing I wanted you to touch on around the same topic that we were speaking on just now was how a lot of how some Africans view African Americans in terms of monetary. You know, can you touch on how you were perceived when you went to the university?
Well, of course, everyone thought I was important.
How they view us and how they think of us because of, you know, I'll let you speak on it.
No, but go on. It is important.
I think it's important that we understand that a lot of times, just like over here, if you in the U.S., in America, if we don't actually take interest and go and learn about some of the African culture, and I've used the word African, the term African lightly, because Africa is a continent with about 52 to 54 countries.
Right.
So, you know, I don't like identifying each country by saying Africa. So when I say Africa, I'm speaking about the continent. But if we don't take an interest in learning about culture, global culture, but specifically within the continent of Africa, if we don't learn about it, we use the images that we see on TV, and a lot of the images that we get said about Africa is they're poor, you know, they're not educated, et cetera. But when you go and look and you do your own research, you find that there are some people who are poor in Africa, and there are maybe some people who may not have access to education like some other places do. However, they have a lot of cities over there. They have a lot of, you know, they have some better options than we have in certain cases. So, you know, there's a lot of culture, and there's a rich culture and everything like that over there. But same thing when you turn the tables and you go over to different countries in Africa and in different places other than the U.S., we're looked at as people that have money because when they look at TV, they're seeing Jay-Z and Beyonce and 50 Cent, et cetera. So that's their depiction of us in addition to how they look at us as in the movies. They think, like you mentioned earlier, they think a lot of African-American women will just have sex with them just because they ask, because that's what that's what the portrayal of us are in a lot of these movies. So I just wanted you to share some of your experience with that when you
Okay, well, definitely. The experience, of course, well, not of course, because you don't know, but the experience is that because I come from the United States, I'm rich. They don't know that I raise funds, and my husband had to send me a ticket to come home, and all this other kind of thing. You know what I mean? So. They just think from looking at our entertainers and the people who are in the media and people in the movies that most black people are rich, very, very rich. And so when I was trying to get into the university, I was met with people that said, well, you know, you have money. We don't, you know, we are not going to give a scholarship to you. Not to mention I came over there on the premise that I was supposed to get a scholarship, and they promised me a scholarship. But now they're going back on it because they're thinking, it's just unfortunate that people are given, as you said, the same negative images of black people, or same mono images. You know, we're all the same. You know, we're rich people. You know that, you know, of course, gold is dripping from every pore, that I can just afford everything. I can just do this and I can just do that. But I do, have to acknowledge that what I had is more than many people there. There are a lot of people that are very, very educated because of that area, Egypt, Sudan, even in Timbuktu. A lot of the scholars, they say the scholars were Sudanese. I'm not sure how that word is used in general, but people are very well educated. There are people that have mansions in Sudan, and then there are the very, very poor. There are homeless people. But you know, but still, if they meet an American, it's they think no matter from what group, unless they're very well educated, they think that Americans are rich, and they didn't want to give me a scholarship because of that, because they thought I was rich. When I would go to catch a taxi, if a Sudanese caught the taxi a short distance, for example, where they would get charged £4. Then I might get into a taxi and ask for the same distance and be charged. They try to charge me £20 or £17. If I got into a rickshaw, which are motorized, very frugal vehicles, a rickshaw you could put like £4 in, and they run probably 100 miles or more. You know, so. They're like have a motor of a moped. So mopeds get like 104 miles per gallon. So the thing you put 2 gallons in, it runs 200 a little bit more miles. Well, I get into the rickshaw, they'd ask for me for £4, where the Sudanese would get in there, they'd ask for 50 pences for the same distance. So
wow.
It's because when you have a foreign accent, so I said very little, because I just didn't want people. If I didn't say anything, they assumed that I was a Sudanese that grew up in the United States, and that's why I looked different. I dressed a little differently, but you know, they didn't think I was totally foreign. I want to shout out to your black child from Facebook, who wants me to talk more about the Candace Queens. So if you don't mind,
Tara,
I'm following your flow. When you like me to talk about it,
I have that on the list here. We're going to go there. Before we go there, mm-hmm. can you touch on during our conversations? You mentioned that some of the Nubians got a little bit offended when you were giving them information or sharing information with them about history, about information regarding the area. They, you know,
mm-hmm.
did you want to
mm-hmm.
go into that?
Well, they know many people know some history, but they didn't know. Just like on our excavation site, there were elders who were over 70 years old who were just amazed at what we were finding there. They'd like, I've been here in this area. I didn't know this stuff was here. I didn't know people used to live here. But they were not offended. But on the other hand, people who think that they're educated, or you know, people that are in the cities, if you just say, I'm studying archaeology, Nubian archaeology. Oh, you come here to try to tell me about my history? I know about my history. Whereas many of them have limited knowledge on their history. Because of the influence of Islam, they have limited knowledge of their history, and they don't think that it is important to know. So they were offended by the fact that I was coming to learn their history, and you know, had the nerve to speak on it and ask them questions like I was. Saying, I was telling a sister friend of mine, I said, well, you know, women at one point in time in Nubia had 5 husbands. I don't know if they were conjugal husbands or not, but they had 5 husbands. And she said, oh, that's a myth. I said, no, it's not a myth. It's not a myth at all. I said, women also attended universities and went to school 6,000 years ago. And she said, Nubia, where do you get these things from? Well, I get them from my teachers, John Henry Clark, Dr. Ben, Renoko Rashidi. Leo Hansberry. The whole lot of our sisters and brothers who've been studying history, but they don't really take time to understand it because to them it's a myth, and it's pagan.
Wow.
Right. I mean
it's very interesting to hear, these examples and the different stories and situations that we run into as we travel and get into some of these studies. But I found that very I wouldn't say I was shocked when you told me that, because I had heard things like that, but is this important for women to know as we're traveling outside of the country, the different ways that we can be perceived and be very aware and are cognizant of how other people view you because of what they've seen on television or what they've been told? Mm. That's just very, very important.
Because they don't have a lot of contact with the African Americans. I was even told that I had a British accent because the people they see on television, a lot of them are from the East Coast. And they hear those New York accents. And when the people they come, that look like me, are from other areas. There are not a whole lot of Americans that come, that have contact with the people. And you know, I did everything I wasn't supposed to do. I pet goats. I ate the food that everybody else ate. I sat with the people. you know. Played with little children. They said, don't go next to children. I taught in a school. The children would kiss and hug me every day. Oh, don't get too much, you know, close to them. Don't eat bread. I traveled on the bus every day. You know, don't, you know, be in close quarters with all, you know, with them, you know, where germs can be passed easily. So, you know, you can't live in a country and listening to these health alerts and all these kind of things. But, you know, for many of them to brush with, you know, when I'm on the bus and I'm not saying anything, they don't really know who I am. Either they think I'm Ethiopian or a Sudanese that lived abroad and came back. And so I try not to say anything. But, you know, I was immersed in the language, so I picked up a lot of the language, you know, while I was away too. So it's just, you know, but I'm taking Arabic classes, and I have a cousin from Somalia, so I'm getting ready to go over to her house and sit with her, and she said she's going to have me straight by the time I get back in a few months.
All right, now let's go ahead. Let me check the switchboard because we just having a good old conversation. And I don't know if anybody has questions.
Okay.
Make sure if you want to call in, if you have a question or a comment, the call-in number is 646-716-7675. Again, 646-716-7675. Make sure that you press 1 on the switchboard, on your keypad, so that you will show up on the switchboard. Now, go ahead and let's go ahead and get into the information in reference to the Kandakes and the queens of Nubia. Let's touch on that because it is very, very important that we get into that.
Nubia has more reigning queens than we know of any other place thus far in what they call, quote-unquote, civilized Africa. I guess that would say that the rest of Africa is uncivilized. But these queens, we think, were probably under, ruling during the time when Aset was the prevalent god. So this is a time, excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold. This was a time when very many queens are becoming prevalent. One of the richest queens that was robbed, and her remains and her gold treasures from her burial goods is a Manetori. Manetori is one of the queens. I went to her pyramid. I actually went in, inside of where they took her, remains in her coffin. There, because the people from Germany and Berlin blew the top off of the pyramids and found a monitory and a King Nanatamaki. So I just don't want to mispronounce his name. And these queens and kings, the queens especially, were a long line of reigning queens that stood on their own. Why it is, we don't know, but we just know that these queens were ruling, they were political, and this was a time when during this time, they weren't only influenced by Egypt, they stood on their own and were and they rose to power, influenced by Egypt, but they had their own unique styles. There's a lot of these queens. Even during that time period, we know that Cleopatra knew of these queens and possibly communicated with these queens of Meroe. So many of them that we could that I could mention. The prevalent queens that I can mention are Amanitore, Amananaki. Those are the most prevalent.
What was the last name you said?
Amananaki, A M A N I N E T E K E, if I remember it right. And she, there's five of them. You can look them up. There, the sources of are very very prevalent, and these queens were running it. There's a one-eyed queen that they make reference to in the Bible. She's a queen, I think, that she, I think she was born with one eye, and they just called her the Candace. They make reference to her in the Bible. So not that we use the Bible as a history book, but it does make reference to her. And she's very powerful. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
How can we look more into these Candaces or Kentakes that you were just referring to?
You can look Candaces up. I'm getting ready to bring up my paper so I can give you all of the names of these queens and how you know and how some of the things that were very important about them. My husband will be putting those on my website for people to peruse and read. And I don't mind if people if people stick holes and criticize it. Okay. So one thing, people wanna put say that the queens were or anything about women into feminist anthropology or feminist archaeology. And it's just archaeology. I don't think that things should be that the queen should be put into separate categories. Okay, there's Amanitere, Amanitere. She lived from 12 BCE on to I think like 100 to 20 BCE. It says 12, which is not correct. But and then there's this is the one I'm trying to spell, Amanashaket, A M A N I S H E K H E T E. She lived from 41 to 12 BCE, and she was a reigning queen of Meroe, was on the throne during or just after the transition from Roman rule in Egypt. And she might have been the forces that attacked the Roman garrison at Aswan, and this is the one that they call the One-Eye Queen. Thus, it may be a royal palace that was located in Naga, and it offered living quarters, multi-column halls, and a maze of corridors and storerooms for her treasures. As modern Sudanese residences, it appears to have had additional living and sleeping space. That's just remarkable that she had a palace with a top floor that people used to stay at. The queen's grave goods and royal interment became as Budge's pyramid. Budge, who translated a lot of Egyptian texts, pretty much sacked her pyramid and ended up taking a lot of the treasures back to Britain. And then Ferlini became known. Her treasures became known as the Ferlini treasures. But this queen is one of the queens that they blew the top off her pyramids and her goods from private residences and in the museums. The other one I was trying to spell was Shenadeti, S H A N A D A K H E T E, lived from 170 to 150 BCE. and was one of the one of the gods' wives of Amun. Like Hatshepsut of Egypt, she was depicted and termed as a male, this queen. And Shepenwepet, 710 to 750 BCE. She's a sister of Taharqa and Shabaka, and is the wife of Amun and belongs to the Theban Amun cult. The last one is the one I was trying to say, Amenardis, A-M-E-N-I-R-D-I-S, 750 to 700 BCE, and she can be considered a model of feminine leadership because she is God's wife of Amun, or divine wife of Amun. Her name contains Amun. A-M-E-N or A-M-A-N refers to Amun, who is the oldest representation of God that we know of in this area. You know, we have other things, Neat and Offset, but this seems to be, of the Nubians, this seems to be the highest god that we've known.
All right. Now,
so did you get all those names?
Yeah, I was writing down. That's why I was quiet. I was writing down, and I will be on the website when the blog gets up. So,
right. So, you know, it's really getting these, getting this information and stuff out here for people to study. It's not about this study is not about me. It's about trying to encourage people to study and people to learn. And, I'm looking for people to call and ask questions. And I know a couple of people said that they were going to be online and calling and asking questions, because I'd like to know what it is that interests people out there about ancient Nubia, about, God being worshipped as a woman, why these queens were so powerful. And this is, and I have to mention the time, the most powerful part time in Egypt is the time when Nubians were reigning in leadership. The 25th, the 26th dynasty, see the 18th dynasty when Queen T is coming from Nubia, and influences fashion. But not only does she influence fashion, how does she influence fashion? By the wearing of the leopard skin, which represents the worship of God as a woman, who with those rosettes in the head, the rosettes in a pedimec shows up into the pantheon of gods shown in Egypt, and so the Nubians really have the most powerful influence on Egypt, and why is that? Because they took it over, and people have respect for these Nubian gods because these people are from their place of origin.
Now, I wanted to touch on something you just mentioned. You mentioned the 18th dynasty, and you mentioned Queen T, and the leopard skin. But can you touch on, as you know of right now, what is the significance between the 18th dynasty and the unification in Upper and Lower Kemet and Nubia? Can you speak on that?
Well, Queen T was pretty much the link to do that, the unification of Upper and Lower. That's why she was identified. And she was a smart sister. She was married between 12 and 14 years old. And this smart Queen T was married to Amenhotep and unified upper and lower Nubia. He had the utmost respect for this sister. Queen T is 1415 to 1340 BC, and she was her husband Amenhotep reigned about 70 years. She's the mother of Tutankhamun. So she had five children. And it just is important because she was a key. She was represented as being a negotiator, and for the political unification of Upper and Lower Kemet. So she's their daughter Tai was born. She was born to a noble family. Her father and mother, Yuya and Tuya, their little stamp, which is a dung beetle, a kepra beetle. And on the other side, there's they announced the wedding marriage, which they probably used this stamp to stamp papers, Pepper's papers. She wasn't from, even though she wasn't royalty, she wasn't from poor beginnings, but she wasn't of the royal family. And so it was important for this Egyptian person, who this Egyptian king, to marry a Nubian queen to unite this land. I mean, because the gold we know is coming from some part of Nubia, and that was one of their chief exports, as well as the iron smelting came from Nubia, which means their weapons were the crafting of weapons came from Nubia. In fact, the ancient Nubia is one of the oldest cities and one of the most famous cities, Taseti, which means land of the bow, because their weapons and stuff were deadly, and their armies and stuff were very important. So she brought with her. For one important reason is because she brought with her that royal army, and they whooped the tail of everybody around there, and they united the nation. So Tai's very important.
Okay, now about the Nubian warriors from, mm-hmm. Can you speak to us in terms of whether these warriors were male or female? Because a lot of the research I've done actually points to the fact that a lot of those warriors were women.
Some of them were women. Some of them were men. There are burials inside of there. There are burials in Nubian and Balana, the Balana sites, Bulana. In A and C group Nubian burials that we think happened right after Nubia was attacked by by Ethiopians. Mm-hmm. There are weapons in the women's graves. Usually, when you bury a weapon in a woman's grave, it means that they're a warrior,
right,
or a warrioress. So. There's definitely some respect to women in that manner. It's not, I mean, we're not totally emphatically sure if women were in the armies. Just seeing Nubian culture of today, I'd say that it probably wasn't a totally women's army, but there are tales in oral history of when the men were beaten down in many wars that the women had to step up and defend themselves, and they were victorious. But they're still fable. Even Candace, the one-eyed Candace, is said to lead her troops from Nubia, to have led her troops into battle. Okay, that's a Manitorian 12 BCE is mentioned as being a successful warrior queen who took her Meroe to victory. All right. So, you know, so the warrior strength of these queens is notorious. Even Cleopatra, who is a mulatto, she has Nubian influences as well, because she rode in front of her army a few times, has been noted too. So, you know, the sisters are stepping up in Nubia. And that's one reason, because that army was so strong, be it women or men, or men and women, or only women and only men, the army is the reason why Nubia was so strong for so long.
Now, we did have some conversation about Berbers. and how the Berbers were originally a group or a tribe or clan of matriarchal a matriarchal clan, if you will. With the influx of some Arabs, that's when they started to become, you know, a mixed or mulatto type of clan and ended up being a more patriarchal clan that ended up invading and trying to get into a lot of the surrounding countries. Could you touch on that, if you will?
Well, it's not just the Berbers. It's the people that we now know that practice Islam. These people, you know, they ended up transferring over from their traditional belief system to Islam, where Allah in the Holy Trinity was much different than it is now. Allah, you know, which they say doesn't have anything to do with it, gets transferred over to Allah, and we think that those things have were definitely related to each other. The Islamic Allah was originally Allah, one part of the Trinity of the goddesses that included Kore, which all of these turn into Quran, the Virgin, and Al-Usa, the powerful one. Together they formed the triad known as Manat, the threefold moon. So, you know, on from that, Islamic Arabia was dominated by the female-centered clans. Marriages were matriarchal, that means inheritance came through the woman. Polyandry, there were several husbands to one wife, was common in this area. So that is why at some point the other, you know, it got changed around. The powerful dynasties to arise in southern Arabia, they came from what we call Kush or Ethiopia. Arabia known as Arabia Felix or Happy Arabia, where the Sabines, a strong matriarchal empire, descended from Kush or Ethiopia. So by the 11th century, the Arab explorers launched some major expeditions into the interior of the African continent to find a thriving remnant of the one-time powerful matriarchal influences still intact in many of the Africa's kingdoms. Now, they've tried their best to wipe this out. I mean, like Sumer and all these places, they tried to wipe them out. There's so much evidence that the goddess ruled in most parts of the country of that world, actually, from Northeast Africa. You know, the area of Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Sudan, you know, those areas of the world, and Somalia were ruled by the goddess and on to the east. Because we talked about the fish-bodied woman, we know that's Vishnu in India. So this belief, especially from Nubia, you know, that they transmitted culture back and forth, because there was possibly a lot of trade between Nubia and India, and in each of them most likely influenced the other. The same as in Egypt, we're finding curry leaves in burials in Mayan burials, and we're finding coca leaves in burials from Egypt, which means that there was some transmission of culture. Not only that they were physically in those places, and that's why they were buried with these spices and these things that were from other. In other words, curry is from Northeast Africa, and coca, which is translated into cocaine, is from South America, where it's just no mistaking. Once you get these plants coming from other areas, of course they could have been cultivated, but first you have to go get them for them to have been cultivated.
Right.
So, exactly. I mean, not to mention that, you know, that whole area was probably a colony, you know, was probably a colony of Kemet anyway. You know, just going by what they wore, what they had. When I was in Cancun, there was an elephant drawn on the side of a building. There were no elephants in Cancun, Mexico. You know, there were no elephants in that part of the country. So it means that they saw these at one point, you know.
When I was in Mexico, I saw a lot of the paintings and different depictions. The skin color of the actual people there and the skin color of the people in a lot of the paintings, the different, like I said, iconography and all that stuff is very indicative of the cultures of where the people came from and the cross-culturing, if you will, of the people. It's not just, you know, a lot of people think, oh, well, they're Mexican. Those people, a lot of the people, when you start traveling and you see the actual people, you see the resemblance of a lot of African features in these people.
When you travel. Exactly. And then when you go to, and you can tell there's been some cross-culturalization physically and everything else, because you can go to Egypt and find people who look South American. Lots of them. So, you know, the bloodline still exists. We're talking about Arabia. You know, Arabia was ruled by queens from Asia, Sumer, and Akkad for at least 3,000 years. It's just true. You know, it was governed by queens for as long as anyone could remember. You know, so they know it's documented 2,500 years back, but if you ask people to go further than that, they say, well, as long as we can remember, it's been governed by queens. So, you know, all this transculturalization, terribly miswritten history. You know, we don't really know if it. You know, we can guess that it's been convoluted on purpose, but the thing is that, you know, even the name Queen Maya is actually the name which is Mayan, which means mother, which comes from an African context and is translated all the way to India and through Asia. So even with the name,
this is the importance of people studying different languages and etymology. It's just very important for us to get into these things.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, time is short. We can't do everything, but, you know, there needs to be somebody who's studying etymology. There needs to be somebody who's studying the Nubian dynasty. There needs to be somebody who's studying the connection between Vishnu. There needs to be somebody who's studying the Indian people. The Dravidian people of India, who their dress and their beadwork is like Kenyans, their whole way of life is like Kenyans and the Maasai, you know, it's just, you know, which is from this area of the world, and it's just very, very interesting that that people just, you know, aren't interested in all this kind of thing.
The thing about what you just said is, at the beginning of the show, I don't know if you probably weren't on the line just yet, but I played a little clip, a Black Universe Her Story moment on Drusilla Dungy Houston. You know, that sister wrote an awesome book, and in that book she explains how the original Kushite Empire stretched from over in the area that's now known as India all the way including the Sudan, and stretching around the west coast of Africa. So when we're saying Nubia or the Ethiopian Kushite Empire, we're not just talking about the place that a lot of people know as Kush now. It encompassed all of India, really parts of Asia, and wrapped around the west coast of the continent of Africa. So,
in other words, it wasn't proper, you know, Nubia proper, what we think of it as today. You know, because if things were just not as delineated, well, you know, it's all, since the Nicene Conference, it's all pretty bumfuzzled up. But you know, it was different. It was different a long time ago, much different.
Definitely. All right, we're going to go ahead and take a brief break. And we want to have some questions and comments about what we were discussing, or, you know, the different pictures that those that have been able to take a look at the pictures on Facebook that Nubia posted. So just give us a call, 646-716-7675. We're going to go ahead and take a break, and we'll be right back.
I remember seeing dark hallways punctured by the light. An angel on my left side, the devil on my right. Whispering in my eardrum, asking who I like. Trying to get me on 18, but I guess I'm too polite. Told them I used to wish I could be better than I am. That I didn't feel the pain, just the pleasure on demand. Tried to exercise the demons, makes a lot, gave some lambs. Then I grabbed the microphone so I could make y'all understand. This is deeper than you know, like valleys and canyons. Surrounded by the yes men and shallow companions. Hold on, I can't breathe, my words getting choked on. I'ma need to translate like DNA codons. This is way more than big beef and show tunes, kingpins, kilos, and record label tycoons. Give me Dookie Chains, a b-boy, and a mic room. Then pull up my name and press download on iTunes. iTunes.
I'm flying lower. This world's a no-world. It's hard to know love when you don't want to see. So we find our camera and let the music feature. And really, you can't see through every little part of me.
Had to hit the rock bottom like stalagmites to reemerge from the ashes as a beacon, pure light. A constant battle between higher and lower. The quickening, gotta pump my brakes, move slower. Sick of the same lessons, time to master, move over. I am present in the moment, attentive and listening. Golden glistening, shift repositioning. Missing the message, trying to hold on to the messenger. Not letting the fear of the unknown get the best of her. Destined to remove laws and put them in a sepulcher. Authentic, not a replica. Adapting with the camera. Transformation placing only the weight of a feather in your breastplate. Take that home, just state. Move your king out of checkmate. Redirect fate. Keeper of the gate. She the 1+8. New demeanor like a Nina. Cock aim. Shoot straight. Straight.
I'm flying over. This world's a no world. It's hard to know love when you don't want to see. So we find our camera and let the music feed you. And then you can see through every little part of me.
Hard to navigate a rugged path with sneaks on. Trying to find a perfect verse that you could ride the beat on. People in your ear saying that they really dig you, but never knew your name before they seen you at a venue. They used to call me tenderhearted, ain't a bunch change. But the skin thick enough and the air done got strange. Believe it when I say it, it's the music, not the fame. But the DJs ain't gon' play it unless you got a bigger name. My name is Sarah, pleased to meet you, now you know me. I only tell them once that I'm the mother, not the homie. Before they try to discount what I bring it to the table, suggest they do their homework, read the stories, learn the fables. I'm creator, and they could put that right here on my ovaries. Anything they do, and now I told them how it's supposed to be. That's coming straight from off the bottom of the ventricle. If you ain't bumping Tyrock, then your playlist nonsensical. Sensical.
I'm flying over. This world's a no world. It's hard to know love when you don't want to see. So we fly like a camera and let the music feed you. And then you can see through every little part of me.
Hello?
Oh, I'm still on mute and I'm just talking. We're looking for go ahead and call in if you have a comment or question. The call-in number is 646-716-7675. We are looking for comments and or questions about, you know, anything that falls under the topic that we're touching on, topics that we're touching on tonight. So, like I said, I have a lot more to go over, but I would love for some of the listeners to call in with questions, because I know you would love to hear some of their questions.
Yeah, I would love to hear some questions, too.
All right. Well, until we get some callers, I don't know why everyone's being shy tonight, or maybe they just want to sit back and listen, but...
how many callers do you have online?
I can see quite a few callers, but they need to press 1 if they have a comment or question. A lot of people may be just sitting here listening, but we can go to the lines just to see. No one has, you know, pressed one to put their hand up just yet, but we can get on the lines to check. Let's see here. We have a caller from area code 804. Did you have a comment or question for Nubia?
Hello, this is Lynn. I have a basic question. Actually, I'm appreciative of the information that I'm hearing, but I have a general question. If the sisters wanted to assist you in your efforts, how can we assist?
Well, I would love people to come out to the excavation sites. I need monetary assistance. I'm going back and forth from here. At this point, I've got a job at the University of Shindy there. But going back and forth, we need equipment. We need wheelbarrows, some basic equipment. We need some wheelbarrows, more trowels, more tools. We need a theodolite. That is to do survey measurements. And eventually we need something, a ground-penetrating radar equipment, so that we can find out exactly where to dig. That means that we're not digging in blindly. And volunteers, 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 hopefully by the 2012 excavation season, even next excavation season, a few volunteers will be fine. But I'll have it organized by 2012, you know, that we can take a few more people on the excavation site. So more than merrier.
Okay, great. And will that information be on your site as far as how to get in touch with you if we're interested in that?
Yeah, you can go to my website at ancientnubiancities.com. That's ancientnubiancities.com. That's ancientnubiancities.com. You can give me a call at 313-864-0708. That's 313-864-0708. And you can also go to my email, which is nubiandigs@yahoo.com.
All right.
All right. Thank you for listening, Lynn. I will put you back on the line. All right. Let's see here. We have a caller from area code 616. Could you let us know who you are and let us know if you have a comment or question for Nubia?
Hello.
Caller from 616.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi.
Do you have a comment or question for Nubia?
Yeah, I have a question. How did you determine when you're digging and you find the information, how do you know what it represents? I mean, is that something?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. I'm standing on the shoulders of other people that have done research before me. So there's certain information that is known, that there's a great portion that is unknown. The Nubia itself, that land is, the Kushite Empire is less than 3% undug. So there's a lot of information there's a lot of unknown things. Like they were finding that the symbol, the woman with the body of a fish, they don't know the name of this goddess, and this goddess is showing its face in different places through Nubia. So some information is unknown at this present time in history, but the way we can find out is there are remnants left in the oral traditions, and there are remnants left in the way some of the traditional people are living in their beliefs, as well as there are remnants inside of Christianity practiced in the area and Islam.
Okay. All right, Lisa, did you have another question for her, or was that it?
No, thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. All right, we have a caller from 478. Could you let us know who you are and what your question or comment is?
Hello. Hey, Sister Nubia, this is Goddess Networks. Hey, Sister Tara, how are you?
How are you doing?
Good. How you doing?
I am good, Nubia. I have a question. Also, sis, and I can't wait to interview you as well. I have a question because you made mention to when you were trying to tell some other sisters about how, you know, it was really a queendom and about ancient Nubia, and some of them were just thinking that it was pagan or something. Let me ask you something. What do you do, especially as a researcher, because I come across that a lot also with women, especially of African or indigenous descent. They tend to think a lot of this stuff is pagan or something else. But I've learned, just because I've studied it long enough, to know that that's where a lot of information is hidden. And if they can name those things pagan or witchcraft and stuff, then people will not research it and study it. But there are a lot of black women that think like that. So what are you are you telling them when they tell you, well, that's not true, though, they're fables, or that's paganism, it's not African and stuff like that?
I said it's part of your tradition, it's part of your history, and it predates Islam. So those things, your history didn't start with Islam. That's what I tell them.
You know what? That's a good idea. All right. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. And look forward to talking to you soon.
All right. Let me see if there is another caller on. Maybe. Area code 513. I think this is Pastor Flowers. Did you have a comment or question for Nubia?
Hi, Miss Pastor Jeanette.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So nice to hear your voice.
It's nice to hear y'all. I'm up here listening, and I just feel like I'm just in beauty. I just see these beautiful minds. You know, we have been so misled about who and what we are, you know, as a people. And, you know, I just enjoyed your encouragement to the sisters that they get into all kinds of fields, you know, linguistics. We need a lot of mentors in our communities, you know, to expose our children. They don't know how to get into these things. And it is just so important, because it shapes everything we feel about ourselves. When we don't know who we are and what we were, and every time you look at everything, it seems to be white.
Right.
And it doesn't have your face on it. And so as you're, you know, being a female and an archaeologist, digging, looking for yourself, and that's what I would like to say to all of the listeners on today's show, because we need to seriously look who we are, because just like you said, it's probably only about 3% to 10% of, you know, Nubia that's even been you know, excavated. So what else are they hiding? Because, see, they do know what they're doing, because they know where to go.
Yes, they do.
You know.
They know they know what not to dig and what to dig and why.
Yes. and you know, really support her, because I'm serious. Most of the most important people in the world, the richest people, control these digs. And for this black woman to be in there looking, when the black indigenous women of the land, the people that occupy the land, don't even know what's there.
They don't. And again, Sister Jeanette, not to cut you off, it's just that, again, that it's not important to the indigenous people. The people that control
the mindset and the way that that's correct. But see, that's how we are right here too.
We're right here too
because, you know, we really don't understand that this is called Temeri. All of this at one time was one, and we have a hard time believing that. You know,
it is, and it was called Temeri, and all of these people that were ruling Temeri were from the land of Kush.
That's right.
They were Kushites, and they were Nubians, and they were Egyptians, if one and the same, because they were colonizing other places just like they were colonizing other places just like they colonized, and that's why the exchange of the coca leaf and the curry is so important. It really tells people that what they were doing, that they were really traveling and exploring and occupying these different places outside of Africa. And even, you know, the mention of it taking 9 months to cross the Nile River, it takes 9 months for you to travel to South America.
That's it. That's it.
You know.
That's it. The similarity. See, we really got to understand that that's where the Bible, when they have Upper Israel and Lower Israel, you see, all of this is mimicking, these were patterns. I mean, we learn about patterns in kindergarten. And so we really have to look at this history. This is more important than we can understand because it controls the politics. And see, the politics are the things that they're using to miseducate you.
Yeah, politics and propaganda. For
yeah.
one, not a lot of us really know what has been done to the maps and the depictions of geography. Some of us don't know a lot outside of the
Correct.
State and the country we're in. You know, I have several books on maps and historical maps, and how it's funny how Europe got larger and larger and how the other continents, well, Europe really isn't a continent. But anyway, how, you know,
right.
certain parts mm-hmm. got larger and the other areas got smaller. And it's
right.
funny how I remember in school when they taught us the continents, they taught us it was seven continents. And I was confused. And my teacher got, she had a smirk up underneath her facial expression because she knew why I was asking this. But I was like, okay, if a continent is a place that's surrounded by water on all four sides, how is Europe a continent?
Mm-hmm.
And I was the only person in class that would ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
That's really
but
a peninsula.
See,
it's not a continent.
Right. But see, we have mm-hmm. not been shown or taught when they downsized, you know, Nubia. Not only was she and is she an archaeologist, she's a teacher. And I know she can attest for how they have downsized education where we
yeah.
used to really study geography. And now it's
mm-hmm.
just all social studies, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they got it all compilated and watered down, you know. So
right.
we have to even begin to look at books. If it's the 20th edition, we need to go to the first edition because that's probably more the
mm-hmm.
truth than anything. Because as we
mm-hmm.
go on and get further away from these things, they water and hide. They hide things to basically for that elite who is finding it. You know, like as she said, she needs support because, I mean, wheelbarrows, you know, tools, that's deep, you know, that they don't even have those things there. But I bet
no.
you the people that really want to know, I bet you they got the money.
They
so,
have the wheelbarrows. We just need the money to buy them. We
yeah,
have a we just
I,
have money
saying.
To get buckets.
They mm-hmm. have it. But the thing
mm-hmm.
here is that we need to find these things out. They're not trying to hurry up and find out, or else you'll be provided
mm-hmm.
for. So these are things they don't want you to really know. You know?
And
so,
also there's also a degree of pot hunting going on.
Yes.
Some of the people that are. that are trying to dig these archaeological sites are just looking for gold and silver and treasure.
Correct, correct.
They're not really interested in the cultural history or the historical value or the contributions. One thing that one of the brothers, there's a movie called Nubian Spirit, and it's by this brother from London.
Lewis Buckley, Black Nine Films. I interviewed him. Marvelous documentary.
Lewis Buckley, the brother, the professor in London there, he found a most important piece, the remains of a wire, a copper wire that was not used for jewelry. It indicates the possibility of electricity being used.
Electric.
Correct.
So, you know what I mean? So we can't think of these civilizations as these backward civilizations.
Right.
They were
like
using a high amount of technology.
They were using real technology, stuff that
real technology.
We're just now beginning. What the technology we have right now is like baby steps. There's been a lot known. I mean, like you said, there's a lot more to go. You know, and we
as our grandparents told us, as our grandparents told us, you know, I forgot more than you know. And
that's right.
Pretty much how it speaks to Nubian history.
Mm-hmm.
Very true. All right, we have about 5 minutes remaining in the live stream. I don't want to take up too much of Nubia's time. But if you have a comment or question, now is the time for you to call in. The call-in number is 646-716-7675. Briefly, before we run out of time, I want you to talk about the southern and northern Sudan, the political and social climate there.
Mm-hmm. We touched on it briefly, but I didn't finish. The southern and northern Sudan, they experienced a vote to split southern and northern Sudan. The vote was won. The law is supposed to be enacted in July, which the reason for the split is because of the slighting of southern Sudan. They were in a vicious civil war, the southerners and the northerners, for 20 years that ended in the mid-'80s. And as a result of that, the northerners have developed their infrastructure, because the capital was in Khartoum. Once before, it was a long time ago. It was in Omdurman when the Turks and the Brits were ruling, but they moved it to Khartoum, and they're ruling, and they're not because they're not. Being fair and equitable with the southern Sudanese, primarily because many of them are Christian and traditional, and very few of them are Muslim. And the north is dominantly Muslim. There are a few Christians and traditionalists, but pretty much no one admits to Christianism and Muslim, in a Muslim country. There's many things going on. The economics, the South is rich, it's oil, very oil rich. And so the North didn't want to split. President Bashir had to recently go and make amends with as best as he could with Sudan, with Southern Sudan, and said, well, you know, whatever you vote for, you know, we'll have to go with it. And there's a lot of things going on. In Northern Sudan, there was terrorism, there was violence. Some people that actually went to southern Sudan in the different factions and the different political organizations, they would intimidate them by burning people in the streets, by hanging them, dismembering people in the streets, dragging them along behind a truck until they were totally dismembered. And this is how the terror tactics is how many of the southern Sudanese were kept in their place and to not speak up. So there's no infrastructure in southern Sudan hardly. There's very few roads. Most homes don't have electricity. But what they do have is a very lush environment, very green. The land, the soil, that is the land of Kush. One of the names that they're looking at for the region is called the Kushite region. It's southern region, South Sudan, Kushite region. And I favor, of course, Kushite region, because those are, if you look at the Pharaonic tribe that is there, there's a tribe in southern Sudan called the Pharaon. Now, it's fabled that the word Pharaon is a Greek word, but the word Pharaon, there's an ethnic group called the Pharaon. And the Pharaon are the ethnic group of the people that created the first pharaoh, which is Narmer. And you can look at their face in the stone figure of Narmer, and you're looking at Narmer in the face. So a lot of these things, to me, they've been distorted. And I wish Southern Sudan well. I plan to buy a home, some land in Southern Sudan. And, the climate in northern Sudan is one of everybody just wants it to be peaceful now. The war tore the country apart. Northern Sudan had to build up. Southern Sudan had to build up. Southern Sudans have fled northern Sudan in the thousands. Northern Sudan it provided buses and trucks to take people back to southern Sudan willingly. But what they wanted to be, they said they didn't say they wanted to come to America. This is a fable that everybody wants to come to America. They said we want our home to be as developed as America and Canada. They don't they just want some roads and buildings and some electricity. So, you know, I'm also interested in forming people who would like to help in the form of bringing my husband is developing an alternative energy company where he will bring them solar panels, if possible, hydroelectric energy, windmill-powered electricity, biomass energy, where you know, the decaying trash is used for fuel and energy. So, you know, I wish them well, and I actually will do my best to help develop the South, because it's been ongoing discrimination that they face. The people in Northern Sudan often call them Janubians, which is Juba Nubians, and the people that were are black in skin color. Some of the people, if you saw them, they're black, towering, beautiful faces and bodies. Actually look. If a sculpture was done on them, you'd say that they were aliens. So this myth that you know, aliens brought all this technology and things, and the reason why they had solar cars and the possibility of solar cars with solar cells and all this other kind of stuff, is because of the look of these people. These people have slanted eyes, very narrow face, triangular shaped faces, many of them, very tall, with a round head. What does that sound like? If you saw a carving or something like that, that's an alien. But it's people who live there. So back when I go there, I'm gonna get some pictures of them, because they look so different than people have ever seen. People would think that I was exaggerating in this description, but there are some very, very, very unique features. And the people are the people in Southern Sudan. Oh my! I talked about the kindness in Northern Sudan. Southern Sudan Sudanese who I've met are even more kinder than that. So.
Now, briefly, before we go ahead and get off the air, I thank you for spending so much time with us and sharing this information. And I strongly encourage, you know, each and every listener that's listening to this show, go out to ancientnubiancities.com and click the donate button, because we need to support Nubia and what she is doing and what she is trying to do for that region. Definitely have to support her and what she's doing. Before I get you to, before we end the show, can you speak about what's going on in Darfur briefly?
Darfur is a very mixed bag of different things. Darfur is, they've had an ongoing war, but the basic reason for it is because the northern government of Sudan wants them to become sedentary and stop being pastoralist. The people, they split. Their guns are coming in from everywhere, from Uganda, from Kenya, and you know, this artillery is from Russia, United States, and Korea, and really looks to me like they're giving them guns so they kill each other off, and then the resources will be left, the homes and things like that. You know, there's many different split offs. The so-called Janjaweed may be in a political group, and then they split off and they become people working for somebody else to rape and kill and to bring about disunity
and
anarchy and things like that. But you know, it's a mixed bag. Some of it is things that they've been fighting among each other for 30,000 years. Some of it is the new things with the government trying to keep them reined in, because I've been to Darfur. There are gates around Darfur. They want to keep the people contained because they don't want people running around, you know, with their cows and their herds.
Right.
Now, Darfur is different when people would think. There are buildings in Darfur. There are towns in Darfur. You know, the things that the U.S. is sending are things that they don't need. You know, they're sending them dried milk and rice and things like that. First of all, they need to find out what the people eat before they say that. People in Darfur do not like dried milk. Why? They're pastoralists. They're used to fresh milk. So they don't even like it. They don't use it. they sell the stuff on the black market. They take the bags out someplace and get money for it. So they need to find out what the people need. And, you know, the rapes and things that have been reported, the reason why they're not reported is because it brings shame upon the women. The women don't want to admit to have been raped. And if they're if they have not been married yet, they people will not marry a woman who is no longer a virgin. And, you know, and
that's,
you know,
going to be a whole different show, I tell you.
Right. And the clitorectomies, that are done predate Islam, you know, and of course, was, you know, of course, were emphasized through Islam because the women, you know, to for that kind of thing. That's another show, too.
Yeah. Well, we will definitely have you back to discuss things further, definitely before you go back to the Sudan region. We definitely have you back on the show. Maybe we can do an on-air telethon to raise some money to support you, because we need to support you, bottom line. You know, what you're doing is extremely important, and we just need to support you. So, like I said before, and like I've been saying throughout the show, we need to go and click that donate button to assist her in what she is doing. And if you are able to actually go over there and physically help her, that's even more of a help.
Please write me. That would be a wonderful birthday present. My birthday is January 25th. To look in that into that PayPal account and find some donations to help me get some wheelbarrows and things for our archaeological sites, the technology that I already told you about. We're definitely in need of having these on our archaeological site, because we have to pay customs to get the stuff out of prison when we come through, so that costs money as well. Transportation to the site is not as much of a problem. You know, we can get buses that are up there. And, you know, next year, if you come along with me, I mean, people say it's hard to get in Sudan, but because I'll be a professor at the University of Shindy by then, and I'm working on an Abu Eritela site, and I have friends that process the passports in Washington and things now, it won't be that much of a problem. And we definitely do a tour of the pyramids and everything. So we make it worth your while to work hard for 6 hours a day, but we play hard, too.
All right. I know Pastor Flowers, I have your line open. I think you might have had a brief comment or question for her before we get off the line.
Yeah, you mentioned that you were trying to get land down in South.
Yeah.
What is the pricing down here?
Oh, wow, they're high. It is, you know, it's hot property right now. Like, you mm-hmm. could get equivalent of an acre, 2 acres of land. They're talking about something like $10,000 American, which mm-hmm. is very high for them, $10,000 to $20,000 American. But I know some families that have offered to give me a piece of their land, and mm-hmm. so you know, we want to get some deals like that, and then I'll erect the building with a couple of different bedrooms, and people can, you know, the idea of having a guest house so business people can come and stay and survey the land mm-hmm. will be a good thing. You know, if I can get my husband to come there and do his alternative energy, then we won't have to rely on the grid in the guest house. And that's what we plan. That's what we plan to do. Give us 5 years
if
we got projects going on.
Okay.
It seems as though everyone is trying to call in with questions at the very end. Come on, we have to respect the sister's time.
It's okay.
I just didn't want to hold you hostage, but let me go ahead and check area code 360. Could you let us know who you are and go ahead and tell us your comment or question?
Hi, my name's Aquanda, and my question is, I'm an anthropologist myself. I'm a cultural anthropologist. And I noticed that I have, I try and get more people of color interested in the field because it's really important to get it from that perspective. So how do you, I mean, all of this seems like it's really beneficial. And I think when you're a person of color, you can see that studying anthropology from this perspective benefits the whole of society. But my problem is, how do you try and get people interested in anthropology in this perspective? I have a big problem with doing that.
Well, the thing is, because you know the reason is because they can't see it as paying their bills. And and so, you know, and that's really the reason behind it, especially African Americans. You know, their main thrust, they don't have the luxury of being from very wealthy families, the great majority of them, and so they can't just study and do what they like. But there is a gold pot at the end of the rainbow. Because you're going into primary research, your written material is going to sell like hotcakes. So if you could get them to understand that especially in studying the ancient Kushites and Meroe and things like that, that their written research material is primary research. It's like the research that Reister has done and Shinning has done. You know, like they're the pioneers of Nubian archaeology. So you could try to get them in that way, and then you can try to get them fascinated with the pyramids and all that kind of stuff. That can be a tour or something like that. But one of my supervisors is Dr. Richard Logan, who is not a man of color, but his main thrust is getting people of color involved because he's had trouble the same way. And it's because people don't see it as being able to pay their bills. But we're going to change that. We're going to try to get some donations, and it's also expensive. The traveling back and forth to go to these faraway lands, it's not expensive. You know, I've spent $8,000 in the last 2 years just on travel alone. So,
oh wow,
you know, it's expensive. It's $1,500 ticket. So, you know, there you go. You know, $4,500, and before that back and forth. You know, it's $8,000, and just appeal to the philanthropic community to the importance of archaeology, and if you could provide scholarships for these students. And just an added note, there are plenty of African archaeologists that are totally not recognized. I went and sat in a school with over I've seen over 500. African archaeologists that are studying at University of Khartoum and University of Shinning.
Wow.
If you could get the children to come and see that, they won't feel like they're isolated, they're an oddity. They'll see that other people of color are studying.
I know that is a big problem because it's so rare to see even like people of color, especially black people, in the field of anthropology.
Right. I'll come back with plenty of pictures of students out there in the field studying with Charles Bonnet and studying with Santori and all these big name people, because they are out there. They just don't, you know, of course it's Charles Bennett and Bonnet who gets all the glory, and really he deserves it because he's doing a lot of really primary study and really doing a good job on the Third Cataract, but he has a lot of help from the university.
Wow, that's awesome. I know you have to go. Can I ask you one more really quick question?
It's up to Tara. Is it okay?
That's fine.
Okay. Super quick. Do you have any, I don't know if you followed the Howard University whole, threatening the impending death of the anthropology department. Do you have any, response to that because of the, the contribution?
Howard University has turned into a law and a literature school, and my response to that is anthropology was created, in fact, to prove the high culture of people who were of no color, of the Caucasian civilization, and what anthropology is beginning to prove is the significant and primary and the superior accomplishments of civilizations when, the European civilization didn't exist. And for that to be dismissed and to deny these young minds and these divine minds at these universities an opportunity to study history is a blasphemy. It's a historically black institution, so they shouldn't deny any part of the word history within their curriculum. That's my opinion, and I'm appalled. I'm appalled that they're doing that.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. All right, please
thank you
email
for calling.
Me so we can work together in trying to recruit.
All right. Well, like I said, thank you so much for coming to share time and spend time with us. And like I said, before you go back, we will definitely, I'm willing to host a telethon, if you will, so we can raise some money to help you. And I'm hoping that I can inspire everyone who's listening to go and press the donate button on ancientnubiancities.com.
All right. Now, thank you so much. That'll be an internet-a-thon, right?
Yeah, internet-a-thon, a telethon. They can call in. They can press the button on the internet. I don't care how they do it, but we need to donate because you are doing wonderful work that we need to help assist you with any type of equipment or anything that you need. So
I really appreciate it. I mean, wheelbarrows would be a first. And thank you so much. And Dr. Flowers, are you on the phone?
She is. Pat Flowers, you still on the phone?
How much does wheelbarrow cost over there?
I don't know. I would guess a wheelbarrow would probably cost about 40 pounds.
And how does that transfer into dollars?
About $20, $25.
Okay.
So, if we could
I'm fixing to send you $100.
Oh,
help.
Wow. Thank you so much. And I'll be returning probably not until September. And I promise every dollar will go to equipment on our archaeological site. And I'll be specific. We're in the long term. We're going to try to build a facility, a sleeping quarters, a lab where we can take things in and wash them off and research them. A library right next to the site, so that the archaeologists have a place to sleep and stay and to store their equipment so it won't be stolen.
That's awesome.
Okay. All right, thank
you
so much.
All
right,
well, there you go.
Right, the first one. And thank you, Todd, for having it. You provided the place for this, so you deserve big thanks for this, and I look forward to it. Just let me know the date and call me, and I'm there.
Well, I will be making a donation as well, and I'm pretty sure I can talk to some women that are within the temple to make a donation on behalf of Black Women vs. Temple to assist you. So look forward to that because
we
have
so
the support.
Much.
Definitely. All right, have a great evening, and thank you to everyone who has been listening tonight. Don't forget to go check that, click the donate button. Have a great evening.
Good night. Bye-bye.
They say the deeper you proceed into darkness, you recognize the difference between the brave and the heartless. Perception chains and visual stimulations are aural vibration, and you decipher reality from the false. I met a group who told me life was in the breath, that the power's in the black behind your eyes, and they can keep the breath. Stress not, cause elevation is the way we get down. We bring it from the bottom of the root to the ground. Full surround sound out your speakers. We build them from the ground like them Zulu parliament teachers. I reach alive and direct from the top of Mount Zion. Fitted to get you fully charged up like an ion. I'm power moving like a rock steady. Kid crushing them like punk cause my lyrics are super heavy. Ready or not, I'm coming, watch me drop, squad on them. Reset the circuit breakers and I get gone on them. Dark is the absence of light. Angry, always on my square cause I'm right. Original, bloodline black like the night. Sovereign, third eye vision, true sight. Dark is the absence of light. Angry, always on my square cause I'm right. Original, bloodline black like the night. Sovereign, third eye vision, true sight.
You are listening to Black Wolfiverse Radio. Mark us as your favorite on Blog Talk Radio and leave comments to let us know how we're doing.
can also find us on YouTube and Facebook. On YouTube, our page is youtube.com/BlackWomanVerse. Subscribe to us there. On Facebook, our page is facebook.com/BlackWomanVerse. Send us a friend request. Black Womaniverse, empowering, informing, and uplifting black women. If you are interested in joining the temple, come see us at www.blackwomaniverse.com. See you there.